Hi, welcome to another episode of the CTO to CTO podcast. Today's guest is Eli Finkelstein, the founder and CEO at Constructor.io, an e-commerce search engine for improving conversion rates. Eli, a search engine expert, is someone who started out his career with a rare mix of interest in both linguistics and computer science. During this episode, Piotr speaks to Eli about the challenge of redesigning how search engines work, transparency with clients, Constructor.io's business goals, and how helping people and being a programmer can actually have a lot in common. Let's begin.
In today's episode, my guest is Eli Finkelstein, founder of Constructor.io. Constructor is an e-commerce search engine used by Sephora and other top retailers for improving their conversion rates. It's pretty unique because it's actually optimized to just sell more. Previously, Eli's career was all about the data, big data at Tumblr and Shutterstock. Hi, Eli. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Eli, how your career started? It seems that you began with a rather academic path.
A little bit. I got into computers when we got our first one around middle school. Mm-hmm. And then in college, I got really interested in linguistics and human languages. Okay. And I've kind of been trying to find ways to work on both of them at once ever since. So At first that was academia.
Yep.
I was doing computational linguistics mostly in university. I did a triple major in math, economics, and computer science, and then kind of gravitated towards computational linguistics. Mm. But then I realized you can have a much bigger effect on the world outside of the classroom.
Right.
So like right now, and you probably run into this as well. I mean, our servers power like a few billion requests a month.
Yeah.
And that's just not something that you would ever be able to do or find in academia. And the satisfaction of having that impact is, for me at least, it's a key driver.
Gotcha. So you get there into big data very early on. Do you remember your first project outside the academia, actually?
Outside of academia?
Yeah.
I don't remember my first project outside of academia. Well, it's funny. I can tell you about my last one in academia, and then I'll tell you about, it'll give me a second to think about the first one
sure.
Outside of academia.
Sure, go on, Eli.
My last one in academia was, I'm telling you just because it's something I haven't been able to work on in a long time. It was something that I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I was doing a speaker sentiment analysis for my thesis, my master's thesis in Aramaic. So I've had like a thing for ancient languages for a while, and I figured that was going to be my last chance to ever work on them because you can't really find a job outside of academia doing that. So that was a lot of fun. And it actually reminds me of my first project outside of academia, which similarly enough was also on something like sentiment analysis, but it was in the financial space. So I was working at a company called FactSet at the time.
Right.
And one of the important things that we needed to do at FactSet was we had all of these analyst reports about stocks that were coming in.
Yeah.
And the faster that you could realize the gist of what an analyst report was saying, if you could realize that faster than anybody else could, then you could take action on it faster than anybody else could. And so the traditional ways were, of course, like a human looking at this and parsing it, but you could actually get to something that was very close to that same level of quality faster.
Yeah.
But using machine learning on top of these things.
Wow. Both two projects actually sounds pretty, like a pretty difficult challenges because for this Aramaic, I guess that you needed to create the whole, you know, model of the language itself. For English, you can find some libraries, some, data you can use for modeling the grammar and all the other aspects. For Aramaic, I guess not.
Yeah, it was. I was naive, as many college students are. It was a lot of fun, the project itself, but I didn't. It was much. It turned out to be much harder than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
To your point, like you have to figure out parsing. Aramaic doesn't have punctuation or anything like that.
Gotcha.
So that makes the problem more interesting, but it was fun.
Sounds like something you can really, you know, dig into and get all the fundamentals, how they work. So actually, it's a very important lesson, I guess. What else have you learned working on Tumblr, Shutterstock, the Blackplane, and your own consulting shop? That were your next, milestones. What have you learned during this time working for those companies?
This is a good question. I guess the biggest thing that I learned was just about what makes me happy in a job.
Okay.
Like,
what is it?
So I'll put it this way. It's like the thing that drives me, at least, is having the greatest impact. Yep. And I always knew that. I'm just trying to think of the right way of phrasing it. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. It's just learning more about yourself through doing these different things to find out what makes you happy. Because you spend so much time at work, and if you're not doing something that makes you really, really happy, that makes you excited to wake up in the morning and check what you're going to be working on that day, then I don't know. It's just kind of sad. And so I was just that was, I guess, the biggest thing that I learned.
I like this answer. Yeah, because otherwise you actually might not have enough time to start being happy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's hard to find time to, if you're only being happy outside of work, then it's hard to find enough time to be happy.
Exactly. Okay. Perfect. How did the idea of starting a new venture come to you?
So funny enough, I was working on search engines for a while before Constructor. Mm-hmm. So I started working on search engines at a company called Shutterstock. They approached me from Tumblr.
Yep.
And the reason I wanted to try working there at all was because I got to work on search.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing about search for somebody who's a little bit of like a computational linguistics nerd is it's really got everything. I mean, if you like computer science and you like linguistics, like you've got all of the most interesting algorithmic problems that you see in computer science. You've got all of the really interesting machine learning problems.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing it across multiple languages and you're doing a whole bunch of NLP, then you've got both the linguistics and the computational linguistics problems. And kind of best of all, like none of them have been solved. Like you still see Google even right now publishing papers on new things that they've invented in search.
Okay.
And these are like thousands of the most intelligent people in the world that have been working on this stuff for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And so the thing that got me into it was I was working on search at Shutterstock, and then I was doing a little bit of that same stuff consulting.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that you really realize as you start working on search is, first of all, it's an unsolved problem. We already knew that. But the second one that's really cool is you can have a huge impact.
Right.
You can see, you can literally A/B test when you make changes to see how much more of whatever it is the company cares about, usually revenue, that mm-hmm. you're making for them.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that I had that impact, knowing that I could cause that kind of impact, that was incredibly satisfying. But at the same time, this realization hits you that's like, you're working on this stuff with maybe a team of a few people.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Amazon and Google, I mean, those guys have hundreds, thousands of people working on this.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like you're inventing arithmetic when they already invented calculus.
You
know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, on the one hand, you're satisfied that you're doing this thing that that causes revenue growth. But on the other hand, you're like, you're really reinventing the wheel. And so the idea for us,
absolutely.
Why we wanted to start Constructor was... we figured let's just do it once, we'll do it well, and then nobody ever has to do it again, and we'll let all of these other companies compete with mm-hmm. Google and Amazon.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So what was the key goal, the key problem you wanted to solve starting the Constructor? If not competing, like not fighting the fights with the Amazon and Google, so what? Like, what was the key goal? By the way, today I was recording another interview with Boris, the founder of Spryker e-commerce platform, and he told me that the biggest lesson he learned along his professional career was to wisely choose the fights you fight. You cannot win all the fights. You need to choose wisely. You choose search for e-commerce. So what was this key goal, the key problem you wanted to solve initially at Constructor?
Yeah, and I actually like that response from Boris quite a bit.
Yeah.
So we knew that the eventual goal was we wanted to let all of these other e-commerce companies be able to compete with the likes of Google and Amazon.
Yeah.
But to get there, you really need to build search from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just build it on top of Solr or Elasticsearch because then you plateau way too early. I think a lot of people have learned that lesson.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. What do you mean you plateau too early? That you are satisfied with the results and you're not investing anymore? Or?
There's a fundamental algorithm that sits at the bottom of both Elasticsearch and Solr. It actually sits on the Lucene layer.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff basically assumes that the fundamentally right way of doing search is an algorithm called TF-IDF.
Right.
Which you're probably familiar with if you've done any kind of like machine learning or especially NLP, you're probably familiar with it. It's this algorithm.
I know how it works, but maybe you can explain it a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah. So it stands for term frequency inverse document frequency. It's actually an algorithm that's been around for, if I remember it, longer than computers. It was invented like 1950s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea of it is to figure out how important a word is or a set of words are to a document.
Right.
You're going to be looking at how frequently they appear in that document. So if they appear more frequently, then they're going to get like a higher value. And then you're also going to look at how infrequent they are across a set of all documents. So if something is very infrequent across a set of all documents, but is very frequent in a certain document, then it's going to be considered very, very, very important. And so
by checking this vocabulary, like general vocabulary frequency, you are removing all the punctuation and other stuff, right?
Exactly. The problem with it is, like, it's a very good general purpose algorithm if you don't have access to, let's say, behavioral data.
Yep.
Like, it gets you okay results, but it's never going to get you great results. And it makes this fundamental assumption that the way that product discovery should work, that search should work, is based off of keyword matching.
Gotcha. Yep.
And yeah, that's just something that we disagree with. Like, really, you should let voters vote with their clicks. But if you want to do that, it turns into a machine learning problem. And you can either build that as a layer on top of Solr or Elasticsearch and still wind up kind of being tied to those algorithms that you don't really want anymore, that TF-IDF or BM25 base.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can build it that way from scratch. And if you look at the Googles of the world, like, that's what they're doing. That was the right thing that we thought to do.
So you have built everything from ground up, right? You haven't relied on those libraries you can find, but actually started building this from scratch.
I'd put it this way. I mean, it's not that we don't use open source. We use plenty of open source.
Yeah.
It's just this one really important piece that everybody else uses open source for, the Lucene, Solr, Elasticsearch part of it, that we built from scratch.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. Actually, this also led me to the next question, because everyone are saying that their product is, you know, AI, ML, machine learning based. What does exactly mean for Constructor?
Yeah, it's a good question. We run into the same thing all the time. And I think we ran into this early on, where when we first started, there were barely any there weren't a whole lot of, especially product discovery vendors that were talking about the AI ML piece.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to name any names, but I can list a bunch of our competitors that weren't really talking about that stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And we started to do it, and we started to have positive effects and getting some pretty good logos. And then all of a sudden, we were looking at our competitors' websites, and you start to see AI and ML appear everywhere, and you're like, damn it.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Because somebody who's intelligent in marketing realized that they could just slap a sticker on there that said AI or ML. And
of course,
you know, if it's a black box, then how can you tell the difference? So for us, there were really two parts to it. The first one is just being effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our customers, they could A/B test us, and at this point we've had A/B tests against just about all of our competitors, and we consistently win them.
Gotcha. Yep.
And so it's like, you know, traditionally with this sort of thing, you might do a feature sale where you try to talk about all the great features that you have, and that stuff's important, but to us it's not the be-all end-all. The be-all end-all is, can we earn our customers more revenue, more profit, more whatever it is that they care about than anybody else?
Right.
And if we can do that, then we feel successful as a company and we feel like we're doing the right thing. And if we can't, then we feel like we've gone astray.
Yep.
The second one is just looking effective. You turn that black box of AI where somebody else will say like, oh yeah, you can't see what's happening in here, but I promise it's happening and it's great.
Yep.
What you do instead of that is you open it up. You show people the actual algorithms. You show them how it works. You let them see it for themselves. You let them see how it's changing. It does two things. The first one is, you know, it shows that we're actually doing this stuff, so they don't have to actually just take our word for it. They can see it. The second one is from the merchandising perspective, it lets them understand why we're doing what they're doing so that they can be smarter about what they do in response.
Okay. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Thank you for the answer. I also saw a demo of a very cool feature you have, guys. It's a voice search. Can you say something more about this feature and how it works? I think it's pretty unique. Yeah.
I appreciate that. It was a lot of fun to work on. One of the reasons that we went into it was there was a report from Google, I think in 2016, like way back in 2016, that was something like 20% of their mobile search at that point was coming over voice.
Well, it's a pretty huge number.
It's a pretty huge number. They haven't published anything about it since, so we don't really know what the number is now, but it was increasing pretty steadily. And we figured, you know, why is that not the case elsewhere? And it's because with Google, you can actually trust that the voice search works well.
Yep.
You try this at most other websites, it's like a gimmick or something like that. It doesn't really work well, and so people don't come back and repeat use it.
Absolutely.
And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to do something that, you know, didn't just demo well, but it actually worked well in the way that Google's works well.
Mm-hmm.
So that if people used it, it actually created a real customer benefit. So it was a lot of fun to work on. I mean, selfishly, it got me back into some of that like linguistic stuff that I was really passionate about. So two birds with one stone, I guess.
Yeah, I think that this is cool that Constructor is pretty much, you know, domain-oriented, working very closely with the database of products you have in your store. So I guess it very positively impacts the accuracy of all those features, not only voice search, but the search in general, right? Because you know your terms, your database of words, of entities, everything very, very well. It's a huge benefit, right? Having this domain-specific approach and focusing on e-commerce solely, not doing the general thing like Solr and Elastic. I really like this idea.
Yeah, we think so. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's cool. What you're actually selling at Constructor, for me, is you are selling the CRO, conversion rate optimization. Like, this is the ultimate value, right, from using Constructor as a search.
I'd push back on that a little. Well, actually, finish your question, then I'll, yeah.
Yeah, but okay. So the question was, if you have any insights to share how much you can actually improve the CR, like conversion rates, over the search experience. You said you are doing a lot of A/B testing, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, I'll answer in two ways. The first one is just like a slight modification, which is we can do CRO, but it's not all that we do. For us, if you're doing search correctly, then you're treating search as a machine learning problem, mostly supervised machine learning problem. And if you're doing machine learning, then you've got some Y variable, some metric that you're trying to optimize for.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be conversion rate. Like, if that's the most important thing to you, you can absolutely put that in there. But the beautiful thing about building this way is you don't have to make it CRO. Like, you could make it revenue if you wanted to. You could make it profit if you wanted to. It's whatever's most important to you as a business. So depending on which customer we're working with, depending on which metrics are the most important to them, you'll see different outcomes.
Yep.
Generally, the one that we see most often is some variant of revenue. RPV we see pretty frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal for us is always, regardless of what we're charging the customer, we want to always make them at least 10x what they're paying us.
Okay.
If we can make them 10x what they're paying us, then they can look at this and they can say, hey, I made a really, really good decision to go with Constructor. And like, yeah, you want to give them all the great features on top and everything like that. But like at the end of the day, when you're evaluating, when whoever has given us their trust, they're evaluating if this is a good idea or not. If they can go to their boss and say, hey, I made 10x ROI on this thing.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to get upset about that.
Of course. Of course. It makes, it makes this decision to buy Constructor a no-brainer. I really love it. It's very, very, very clear value proposition. Perfect.
Well, just one other thing I'll mention on that is like it's less about the value proposition for us and it's more about just repaying the trust afterwards.
Okay.
Like that's the main thing. I mean, because you can sell on a whole bunch of different things to get somebody into the door, but like these people, they trusted us. I mean, they trusted us with one of their major initiatives for the quarter. They trusted us with really a whole lot of their cash, and we want to make sure that afterwards they can look back on it and say this is a great experience.
Okay, Ali, maybe let's switch a little bit to the venture building part of Constructor, not the product itself. What's the biggest challenge scaling search technology at the enterprise level, at this level you have at Constructor?
Can you explain the question a little bit more?
Yeah, this question can be answered in two different ways. First, technically, what's actually the scaling? How is scaling the search on a large number, of customers, huge traffic, sometimes unpredictable. So that's the tech part of this question. But on the other side, I think that the question is more business oriented. And I guess scaling the search on enterprise level also means how you convince the clients to buy it, because this market, search engines market, is pretty saturated. So I guess scaling it is not that easy, right? Because you need to figure out how to get the adoption. And so on one side, this question is about the tech. On the other side is on adoption.
Yeah. Well, do we have time? I can answer both.
Yeah, go on.
All right. So the tech side, which for me at least, it was the more fun side at first. So there's a few ways. The first one is I'd been an engineer for a while, and one of my two favorite principles in engineering are horizontal scaling.
Right.
Is the first one, and the second one is no single points of failure.
Gotcha.
And so when I was trying to build this thing, the key was, you make it so that the servers that are serving requests from the customer, stuff that's directly impacting the customer immediately, like anything returning like auto suggest results or recommendations or search results or whatever, all of that stuff should, first of all, not be dependent on like a single database or something like that that can go down. One of the things that we did that was a little bit unique, especially because we're not building off of Solr or Elasticsearch or anything like that, is that each one of our customer-facing product discovery servers, they all have a copy, their own copy of the entire index that they need to be serving off of.
Oh, so it can be distributed worldwide. It's awesome.
Exactly. So the beautiful thing about this, which I think you're touching upon already, is if they're all serving off of their own index, then if half of them go down, the other half are still fine. They're not dependent on it at all.
Yeah.
If a database goes down, everything's still good. You're not dependent on that at all. If you're familiar with the Hippocratic Oath, we kind of take something similar to the Hippocratic Oath for our customers, which is like, it doesn't matter what kind of machine learning you do, what kind of great features you put in. If you've got downtime, if you're causing harm with something that you're doing, it basically cancels out all of the benefit.
Gotcha. Yeah, of course.
So it was like, before everything else, no downtime ever. We can't have downtime. So the two ways that we accomplish this are the no single points of failure. And then also, if you've got each server serving it off of its own index, then you can 100% horizontally scale.
Yeah.
You can, if you've got a problem, you've got a whole bunch of requests happening all of a sudden, as long as you've engineered correctly and your servers come up quickly, you can always just throw more servers at the problem.
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
So that was the fun technical part. And then you asked about the business part as well. the number one thing there is just understanding the people that use it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're selling into an enterprise, and I think you've probably run into this with Devante as well,
yeah,
it's just critical to understand all of the different people that are going to be making use of your product.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Your user is not just one person. It's a merchandiser. It's a
single person. Yeah,
exactly. You've got merchandisers, you've got business users, you've got engineers, you've got marketing people that are using this. You've got SEO implications, and like everybody's got different needs throughout that. And you really need to understand each mm-hmm. and every single one of those personas and what their needs are to be able to make something that makes all of them happy.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. Good answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. How about the organization itself? How many people work at Constructor at the moment?
So we've got about 40 people.
40 people, okay.
Yeah.
What are the key roles? Like mostly engineering roles or?
Yeah, we're more than half engineering, but
okay.
At this point, I mean, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but we've got more interest than we used to have. So the sales team has been, over the last few months, the fastest ramping team.
Yeah, makes perfect sense, of course. Especially as for enterprise software, you need to have this sales team. How long it took you guys to build the MVP?
It took a while.
this it was more like 3 months or 3 years.
So to build the MVP of the actual search product, the beginning of our product discovery suite, that actually did take about 3 years.
Wow.
So we started off with something very simple. We started not very simple, but we started off with just building auto-suggest from scratch.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
The reason that we wanted to do this was I think it's one of the major reasons nobody else builds from scratch. Like why everybody uses Solr and Elasticsearch.
Yep.
You get up and running so much faster.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you're building off of these things, you can have an MVP in a few weeks.
Yeah,
you plateau faster, which is why we didn't do it. But if you just want to get to market, like that's absolutely the right answer. What we wanted to do was we wanted to build something that was interesting enough that we could get people to try it out, mm-hmm. that we could get people to A/B test it and see the results for themselves, see how much additional revenue they were making.
Yep.
But also wouldn't take, you know, an eternity to build. So we started off with auto suggest. That actually did take us, I want to say like 5 months. It was like me working out of coffee shops mostly for 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
We started giving that to customers. We got some good reception and were able to raise some VC money off of it. And then that was the money that we used to spend about 3 years building the actual search suite.
Awesome.
And yeah.
Do you remember your first customers? Maybe some funny story.
actually, yeah, and I wish you wouldn't have asked me that, but yeah, I'll tell you. So it's a little bit of an embarrassing story. I was at a bar mm-hmm. in San Francisco, and if you know bars in San Francisco, you know most of them have a lot of engineers in them.
Yeah.
As we code and then maybe we go have a beer or two. And I was about three beers in, so not drunk, but not completely sober either. And I overheard somebody behind me talking about how they were about to build an auto suggest at their yeah. company. And I walked over and I told them that was a bad idea.
Okay.
What they should do instead is we've got this really amazing auto suggest that like it'll provably increase the whatever the business metric is that they cared about, and they should try that instead.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, this incredibly kind group of people decided to keep talking to me. I can only imagine putting myself into those shoes, and like somebody comes up to you in a bar, you know, not completely sober, trying to sell you something. Like you probably don't talk to them, but for whatever reason, these people were incredibly nice and they kept talking to me. And after seeing a demo and seeing what it could do, they decided to give it a shot, and they're actually still customers today. I don't want to mention their name because I don't want to like put them on the spot about what happened originally.
Yeah. Great story.
Yeah, that was back in the good old days.
Great story. You can put it also another way, like, you know, you're in a bar and some, you know, and guy is approaching you and solving your most difficult problem with the startup they are building. So.
I wouldn't trust that for a second.
Awesome. Okay, Eli, what are the goals for Constructor in the next 3 years?
I mean, our goals have really remained pretty consistent throughout the life of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we take a lot of inspiration from what some of the giants that have done this stuff before did. I mean, like when I think about somebody like Google, like mm-hmm. how did they become successful in the first place? You look back into the late 90s and all of their competitors had way, way, way more features than they did.
Yep.
I mean, they were doing way more different things than they did. And you take Google and it comes in and it's got this super simple interface. I mean, yep. It's most of the page is white. It's not doing anything. There's just a search bar on there. And the reason that everybody starts using it is they've really got one feature at that point. The results are much better than anybody else's. And we kind of took that same philosophy and we want to continue taking that same philosophy, which is we'll build features. It's not that we're never going to build any features, but the primary thing, our kind of like North Star metric is, are we providing more value every single month, every single year to our customer than we were providing in the previous time period?
Yep.
If we can continue to do that, then I think we're serving our customers in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. And we're really being true to ourselves as a company.
Yeah, makes perfect sense to me. You know, actually, I remember the time when I switched over to Google. Before, I was using AltaVista and Infosig, I guess. Those two engines were doing the best job here in Poland, not only, I guess. But then all of a sudden, Google popped up, and it was like, it was even more than 10 times better, right? It just works. No reason to use any other search engine. Even they had all those, you know, domain specific file search, news group search, whatever. It didn't matter, right? And I think that this approach you have is a great recipe for huge success.
Thank you. It's been fun so far.
Yeah, making it very, very clear why to use your product. That's cool. Okay, so we are heading towards the end of our interview. Actually, I have just two more questions, pretty general ones. So first is, what is the next big thing for search in e-commerce? Let's put it that way. Next big thing, search in e-commerce.
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening in the realms of vector search.
Mm-hmm.
We do a little bit of that stuff. When you like get into the nuts and bolts of how Constructor works, it's more of an ensemble model.
Yep.
Without getting too much into those, but we use mostly ensemble models. One of the pieces of the ensemble model is already vector search, but I think as time goes on, more and more vector search will become the standard. And the reason for it is one of the big problems in e-commerce search is if you're doing like the basic keyword matching, the traditional keyword matching,
mm-hmm.
you're matching on keywords that happen to exist in a term but aren't really relevant to that product.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is like somebody searching for an iPhone and getting an iPhone case. Like, does it have that word iPhone? Sure, it does. But you've got this other piece that adds different meaning to it, that yep. case word. If you're looking at vector search and you start looking into embeddings, I won't go too much into here, but you're basically learning about the words that are neighboring each individual word, giving it context. As you start doing that, you start solving that problem of those irrelevant results that are coming mm-hmm. back just based off of keyword matching in a very automated way that, and this is the best part, is language agnostic.
Okay.
To me, like that's where things head in the future. Like right now you've got all of these great models that a lot of folks use for independent languages. And mm-hmm. so they wind up being like really great in English, for example. But then as soon as you move it to Polish, like the thing doesn't work.
Yep.
The more you build this stuff in a language agnostic way, the more you can serve your customers, you can serve their many languages, and you can do more of this stuff automatically instead of relying on these like very custom built models.
Awesome. Thank you. The last question, the biggest learning from your professional career. You already said that the learning you had before starting Constructor was what makes you happy and how to follow this route. But maybe you can share something else, like the general biggest learning of your whole professional career.
I'll share one that it's a little bit embarrassing, so that's why I'll share it. I think it's kind of interesting. I was an engineer for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I never expected was just how much I enjoy the consulting, like talking to customers, getting them using the product part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I imagine that, you know, my favorite part would be like sitting in a room and geeking out with people and just building the thing, and somebody else goes and figures out how to sell it. It turns out that I get a huge amount of satisfaction, probably at this point, honestly, even more than building, from being able to use what we've built to solve real people's problems.
Awesome.
So that's maybe something for the engineers that are listening to this. Like, I never thought of that about myself before I started doing it. You might not be thinking that about yourself, but it's worth giving it a shot, because helping people feels really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I was never thinking about myself as a guy recording interviews. I was just coding things before, as you said. And I step over my, you know, comfort zone. And I guess I feel the same what you are trying to share here. That it's really good to learn more about your other skills you have and not even are aware of. So you can do this just by, you know, experiencing many, many, many different things. So you found your you know, satisfaction in consulting the clients, which makes perfect sense, because this is the opportunity for you as an engineer to see how your stuff is actually working in the real world, right? It's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And if you get to do it yourself, then you get to make sure that, you know, it's talked about correctly.
Exactly. Okay, perfect. Eli, thank you very much for this interview. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great. Guys, if you have any questions, please feel free to post them in the comments and we will try to answer. Thank you once again, Eli.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. If you enjoyed this show and if you found this episode useful and informative in any way, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. This can help us tremendously in reaching other listeners who might also be interested in these topics. And of course, as always, we'll be back with great content next week.